love," Joseph heard his mother whisper to his father. "Be strong, like you were before."
"But I wasn't," Joseph's father blubbered. "I wasn't strong. I was just lucky. It could have been me. Should have been me."
The Cuban doctor was getting closer. Joseph had to do something. But what? His father was inconsolable. The things he said he saw, Joseph couldn't even imagine. His father had only survived by staying quiet, by not drawing attention to himself, but now he was going to get them sent away. Suddenly, Joseph saw what he had to do. He slapped his father across the face, hard. Papa staggered in surprise, and Joseph felt just as shocked as his father looked. Joseph couldn't believe what he'd just done. 6 months ago, he would never have even dreamed of striking any adult, let alone his father. Papa would have punished him for such disrespect. But in the past 6 months, Joseph and his father had traded places. Papa was the one acting like a child, and Joseph was the adult. Mama and Ruthie stared at Joseph, stunned, but he ignored them and pulled his father back in line.
"Do you want the Nazis to catch you? Do you want them to send you back to that place?"
Joseph hissed at Papa.
No,
his father said, still dazed.
"That man there," Joseph whispered, pointing to the doctor. "He's a Nazi in disguise. He decides who goes back to Dachau. He decides who lives and who dies. If you're lucky, he won't choose you. But if you speak, if you move, if you make even the slightest sound, he will pull you out of line, send you back. Do you understand?"
Joseph's father nodded urgently. Beside him, Mama put a hand to her mouth and wept, but she didn't say anything.
"Now, clean yourself up. Quickly," Joseph told his father.
Aaron Landau dropped his wife's hand, dragged his oversized coat sleeve across his face, and stood rigidly at attention, eyes forward, like a prisoner. The doctor came down their row, looking at each person in turn. When he got to Papa, Joseph held his breath. The doctor looked Joseph's father up and down, then moved on. Joseph sagged with relief.
They'd made it.
His father had passed the doctor's inspection. Joseph closed his eyes and fought back tears of his own. He felt terrible for scaring his father like that, for making Papa's fears worse instead of better. And he felt terrible for taking his father's place as the man in the family. All Joseph's life, he had looked up to his father, idolized him. Now it was hard to see him as anything but a broken old man. But all that would change when they got off this ship and into Cuba. Then everything would go back to normal. They would find a way to fix his father. The Cuban doctor finished his rounds and nodded to the ship's doctor that he approved the passengers. Joseph's mother wrapped his father in a hug, and Joseph felt his heart lift. For the first time all afternoon, he felt hope.
"Well, that was a sham," said the man standing in line next to him.
"What do you mean?"
Joseph asked.
"That was no kind of medical inspection. The entire business was a charade, a giant waste of time."
Joseph didn't understand. If it wasn't a proper medical inspection, what had it all been for? He understood when he and his family lined up at the ladder on C deck to leave the ship. The Cuban doctor was gone, and he'd left Cuban police officers behind in his place. They were blocking the only way off the ship.
"We've passed our medicals, and we have all the right papers," a woman passenger said to the police. "When will we be allowed into Havana?"
"Mañana," the policeman said in Spanish. "Mañana."
Joseph didn't speak Spanish. He didn't know what mañana meant.
"Tomorrow," one of the other passengers translated for them. "Not today. Tomorrow."
Isabel. The Straits of Florida, somewhere north of Cuba, 1994. One day from home. Isabel hit the water and sank into the warm Gulf Stream. It was pitch black all around her, and the ocean was alive. Not alive with fish, alive like the ocean was a living creature itself. It churned and roiled and roared with bubbles and foam. It beat at her, pushing her and pulling her like a cat playing with the mouse it was about to eat. Isabel fought her way back to the surface and gasped for air.
Isabel!
Her mother shrieked, her arm stretching out for her. But there was no way her mother could reach her. The boat was already so far away. Isabel panicked. How was it so far away already?
We have to get the boat turned,
Isabel heard Luis cry.
If we don't meet the waves head on, they'll roll us over.
Dad! Yvonne yelled. Isabel spun in the water, and a wave slammed into her, filling her mouth and nose with salty water and sweeping her under again. The wave passed, and she broke the surface, gagging and choking, but she was already moving toward the place where she had seen Señor Castillo's head before it went under. Her hand struck something in the dark water, and Isabel recoiled until she realized it was Señor Castillo. The sea was tossing him around, but he wasn't moving on his own, wasn't fighting to get back out of the water. Isabel took in as much air as she could and dove down beneath an oncoming wave. She found Señor Castillo's body in the dark, wrapped her arms around him, and kicked as hard as she could for the surface. The ocean fought her, sweeping her legs out from under her and spinning her all around, but Isabel kicked, kicked, kicked until her lungs were about to burst, and at last she exploded up into the cold air, gasping.
There! There they are!
Yvonne cried. Isabel couldn't even try to look for the boat. It was all she could do to keep Señor Castillo's lolling head above water and catch quick breaths before the waves rolled over them both. But the waves seemed to be smaller now, still deadly, but not as high and fast. Isabel began to feel the rhythm of the sea, the sing-song lullaby of it, and it was easy to close her eyes, to stop kicking, to stop fighting. She was so tired, so very, very tired. And then Yvonne was there in the water with them, his arms around her, like they were back in their village playing together in the waves on the beach.
Here! Here! They're here!
Yvonne shouted. Their boat was now alongside her, and her head thumped into the side of it as a wave washed over her. Hands lifted Señor Castillo from her, and soon they dragged her over the side, too. She splashed back down into the half-meter of water that filled the boat. But she was away from the waves, the never-ending waves, and she collapsed into her mother's arms.
Rudy! Rudy! Oh, God! Señora Castillo cried,
clutching her husband's hand. Señor Castillo was unconscious. Luis and Papi had laid him out on one of the benches, and Isabel's grandfather was pumping his stomach like an accordion. Seawater burbled up out of Señor Castillo's mouth, and he suddenly lurched, coughing and spluttering. Lito and Papi and Luis rolled him over, and he retched up the rest of the ocean he'd swallowed.
Rudy! Rudy!
Señora Castillo said. She wrapped him in her arms and sobbed, and then everything was quiet and still, but for the gentle lapping of the sea against the side of the boat and the sloshing of water inside it. The tanker had passed. Amara stood at the back of the boat, keeping the rudder straight against the waves. But the engine was dead again. Like everything else, it had been swamped. Señora Castillo reached for Isabel's hand and squeezed it.
Thank you, Isabel.
Isabel nodded, but it came out more like a shudder. She was freezing cold and soaked from head to toe, but at least she was back in her mother's arms. Mommy hugged her close and Isabel shivered.
We need to get the water out of the bottom of the boat,
Papi said. It was strange to Isabel to hear her father talk about something so normal, so practical, when Señor Castillo had almost drowned and the boat had almost rolled over and sunk. But he was right.
And get the engine running again,
Yvonne said.
The water first,
Lito agreed, and together they gathered up bottles and jugs and began the tedious work of filling them and pouring the seawater back into the ocean. Isabel stayed buried in her mother's arms, still exhausted, and no one made her get up.
Where's the box with the medicine in it?
Luis asked. There weren't too many places it could be in the small boat, and they quickly decided it must have fallen overboard in the confusion. Gone were their aspirin and bandages, and Señor Castillo was still dazed and weak. It was bad, but if they got the boat bailed out, and if they got the engine running, and if they got back on track with the sun tomorrow, and if they didn't run into any more tankers, they could make it to the States without needing the medicine or matches. If. They bailed water the rest of the night, taking turns dozing in the uncomfortable, crowded little boat. Isabel didn't even realize she'd fallen asleep until she jerked awake from a nightmare about a giant monster coming for her out of the dark sea. She cried out, looking this way and that. But there was nothing but blue-black water and gray skies tinged with the red of the sun all around them for miles and miles and miles. She closed her eyes and took deep breaths, trying to calm down. The boat rocked again, and Amara struggled to keep the rudder steady. She had taken over as pilot while Señor Castillo recovered, but they still hadn't gotten the motor running again. The Gulf Stream would carry them north, toward Florida, but they would need the engine to reach the shore. Isabel's mother leaned over the side of the boat and threw up into the sea. When she slid back down inside, she looked green. The boat was rocking so much now, Isabel couldn't sit on the bench without holding on. The waves were growing higher and higher.
"What is it?" Ivan said sleepily. "Another tanker?"
"No. Red sky at morning. Sailors take warning," Lito said, looking up into the red-tinged clouds. "A storm is coming."
Mahmud, Izmir, Turkey, 2015. 11 days from home.
"God help us! That is what we are to ride in?" Mahmud's father said.
The boat wasn't a boat. It was a raft. A black inflatable rubber dinghy with an outboard motor on the back. It looked like there was room for 12 people in it. 30 refugees waited to get on board. They all looked as tired as Mahmud felt and wore different colored life jackets. They were mostly young men, but there were families too. Women with and without hijabs. Other children, some who looked to be about Mahmud's age. One boy in a Barcelona soccer jersey didn't have a life jacket, but clung instead to a blown-up rubber inner tube. A few of the other refugees had backpacks and plastic bags full of clothes, but most of them, like Mahmud's family, carried whatever they owned in their pockets.
"Let's go, let's go," one of the smugglers said. 250,000 Syrian pounds, or 1,000 euros per person. Children pay full price, including babies," he told Mahmud's father.
There were two more Turks in tracksuits, like the ones who had turned them away from the mall, and they stood apart, staring at the refugees like they were something disgusting that had just washed up on the beach. Their scowls made Mahmud want to disappear again. Dad handed out their life jackets, and they put them on. Mom stared out at the black dinghy, bobbing in the gray-black Mediterranean seawater. She grabbed her husband's arm.
"What are we doing, Yusuf? Is this the right decision?"
"We have to get to Europe," he said. "What choice do we have? God will guide us."
Mahmud watched as his father pushed the cash they'd saved into the hands of one of the smugglers. Then, Mahmud and his family followed his dad to the dinghy, and they climbed on board. Walid and his mother sat down in the bottom of the dinghy, his mother holding Hana tight in her arms. Mahmud and his father sat on one of the inflated rubber edges, their backs to the sea. Mahmud was already cold, and the wind off the waves made him shiver. A big bearded man wearing a plaid shirt and a bulky blue life jacket sat down right next to Mahmud, almost squeezing Mahmud right off the edge. Mahmud slid a little closer to his father, but the big man next to him just settled into the extra space.
"How long will we be on the boat?" Mahmud asked his dad.
"Just a few hours, I think. It was hard to tell on the phone."
Mahmud nodded. The phones and chargers were safely sealed away in plastic bags in his parents' pockets,
just in case they got wet. Mahmoud knew because he'd been the one who had dug through the trash for the resealable zipper bags.
"We don't have to get all the way to the Greek mainland," Dad said. "Just the Greek island of Lesbos, about 100 kilometers away. Then we're officially in Europe, and we can take a ferry from there to Athens."
When the smugglers had packed the dinghy full of refugees, they pushed it out to sea. None of the smugglers came with them. If the refugees were going to get to Lesbos, they were going to have to do it themselves.
"Does anyone know if dinner is served on this cruise?"
Mahmoud's father asked, and there were a few nervous laughs. The outboard motor roared to life, and the refugees cheered and cried. Dad hugged Mahmoud, then reached down to hug Mom, Walid, and Hannah. They were finally doing it. They were finally leaving Turkey for Europe. Mahmoud looked around in wonder. None of this seemed real. He had begun to feel like they were never going to leave. Mahmoud had been so tired he could barely keep his eyes open before, but now the thrum of the motor and the chop of the boat as it hit wave after wave flooded him with adrenaline, and he couldn't have slept if he'd wanted to. The lights of Izmir dwindled to glittering dots behind them, and soon they were out in the dark, rough waters of the Mediterranean. Phone screens glowed in the darkness, passengers checking to see if they could tell where they were. The roar of the engine and the whip-blinding sea spray made it impossible to have any kind of conversation, so Mahmoud looked around at the other passengers instead. Most of them kept their heads down and eyes closed, either muttering prayers or trying not to get sick, or both. The dinghy began to toss, not just front to back, but side to side, in a sort of rolling motion, and Mahmoud felt the bile rise in the back of his throat. On the other side of the dinghy, a man shifted quickly to vomit over the side.
"Watch out for the Coast Guard!" the big man next to Mahmoud shouted over the noise. "Turks will take us back to Turkey, but Greeks will take us to Lesbos!"
Mahmoud didn't know how anybody could see anything in the dark, cloud-covered night, but it helped his seasickness to look outside instead of inside the boat. It didn't help his growing sense of panic, though. He couldn't see land anymore, just stormy gray waves that were getting taller and narrower, like they were driving a boat through the spiky tent tops at the Kilis refugee camp. More people leaned over the side to throw up, and Mahmoud felt his stomach churn. And then the rain began. It was a hard, cold rain that plastered Mahmoud's hair to his head and soaked him down to his socks. The rain began to collect in the bottom of the dinghy, and soon Mahmoud's mother and the others were sitting in centimeters of shifting water. Mahmoud's muscles began to ache from shivering and holding the same tight position for so long, and he wanted nothing more than to get off this boat.
"We should turn back!" someone yelled. "No, we can't go back. We can't afford to try again," Mahmoud's father yelled, and a chorus of voices agreed with him.
They pushed on through driving rain and roiling seas for what felt like an eternity. It might have been 10 hours or 10 minutes. Mahmoud didn't know. All he knew was that he wanted it to end, and end now. This was worse than Aleppo, worse than bombs falling and soldiers shooting and drones buzzing overhead. In Aleppo, at least, he could run, hide. Here, he was at the mercy of nature, an invisible brown speck in an invisible black rubber dinghy in the middle of a great black sea. If it wanted to, the ocean could open its mouth and swallow him, and no one in the whole wide world would ever know he was gone. And then, that's exactly what it did.
"I see rocks!" someone at the front of the dinghy yelled, and there was a loud boom, like a bomb exploding,
and Mahmoud went tumbling into the sea.
Joseph. Just outside Havana Harbor, 1939. 17 days from home. A strong hand grabbed Joseph by the arm and swung him around. It was a sailor, one of the ship's firemen, and Joseph knew right away he was in trouble. The firemen were big, churlish brutes who were supposed to be on board to put out fires, but lately they'd been walking the decks, harassing the Jewish passengers. They'd been making trouble ever since the Cubans had told them they couldn't leave the ship.